and it says it's for your primary home, they might not think to ask what it was used for, because the what you've used those proceeds of that loan for is what's going to determine if it's deductible or not sometimes. So you always want to let them know, like, I pulled out 100 grand, but I bought a new rental with it, or I did this with it, or I, like, if you used it to buy a ski boat, not deductible probably, unless you ran a vacation business, you know, but let them know, because it gets missed a lot. And there's a lot of interest not being deducted when it could be.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Natalie Collotti is a real estate tax strategist who has owned her own firm since 2017. She has invested in mobile homes, short-term rentals since 2014, and is the co-founder of the National Association of Real Estate Tax Strategists, a nonprofit whose purpose is to provide great education, resources, and guidance to taxpayers when it comes to real estate taxation, as well as to provide access to certified real estate knowledgeable tax professionals. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hey, the pleasure's mine. I'm excited about today's show. But before we really jump into the main topic of today, can you quickly give our listeners a background, where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Yeah, so I ended up kind of falling into tax and real estate as kind of a combination on accident. I graduated with a degree in tax, and I always tell people I started in real estate the worst way you can, I think, which was I paid for like the guru weekend seminar. So while that wasn't maybe my finest move, it's what sort of opened the door for me. And that's how I found a bunch of the resources I have and what really got me sort of leading down that path. So I had the overlap of the two, and I've kept in real estate. And then on the tax side, just ended up very specialized. And that's why I ended up opening my own firm. So now I work exclusively with real estate investors on the tax side of things. So it's, I think, a lot better to be really good at one thing and really specialized than kind of a jack of all trades. And that's sort of where I've landed. So, yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah. We say the same thing, you know, obviously on the real estate side, which is pick your niche and get rich. Mm-hmm. Or the other idea behind that is to go an inch wide and a mile deep. So yep. I love the specialization of, you know, what it is that you're doing, because there's so many nuances to it. The thrust of today's show, which this will be a little bit different show, just in the sense that normally it's a very conversational, and this will be conversational yet, but normally it's like, okay, hey, we just kind of let the conversation go where it is. But you've got a really fascinating ebook, I think, you're putting together right now. And it's something along the titles of the 10 most common tax mistakes, or maybe you can tell us the title, then we can go through that.
Yeah, it doesn't have a set title yet, or I would. It's one of those things where I was told to pick a list and let someone who's like knowledgeable on marketing pick the final title.
Right.
But you can find it through me or my website. It'll be out in the next few weeks. But yeah, basically what it came down to and the whole reason I was putting this together was, I would say close to 40% of the returns I get when I'm looking over someone's prior returns have some kind of a major error on them, especially with real estate, where they either need to be amended, or there was just money missed, or something was done blatantly wrong, or depreciation was wrong. And that's a huge thing in real estate. And it's something that gets done incorrectly often. So the purpose of it was just to kind of give people a heads up, like, here's sort of a checklist of things to look for. It's not like a teach you tax strategy book. We're not diving into the nitty gritty, but like, look at A, B, and C. And if one of these doesn't match up, go to the next step, like ask questions, look at this, look at that, figure out why it doesn't. Sometimes there's a reason. Sometimes your tax person might not know real estate. So that's kind of the purpose of it. So I thought I'd kind of share some of those topics with you guys today and give you a little bit of an extra head start.
I love that. I love that. I love the idea of putting that guide together. And I would really think our listeners would find it valuable if you can really just break down those 10 items. What are they? How do we avoid them? And what are the mistakes you see people doing?
Yeah. So there's a handful of mistakes. Like I said, when it comes to real estate taxation, it's like, there's a lot of returns that need to be fixed. And it's often just this same handful of things, and they get missed for various reasons. But I'm kind of starting with the simpler things that aren't complicated, but are off a lot and are just easy to spot. The first one is looking at your Schedule E, which is where you report rentals you own in your personal name or in a single member LLC. They'll go on your 1040 on Schedule E. Things that get missed there are the fair rental day reporting. There's a box on Schedule E where it asks for your fair rental days for the property. And this doesn't do anything tax-wise unless you also lived in it part of the time, kind of like a vacation home. But this is something that I've had a lot of lenders tell me they see wrong, and it's something they use. So when they're looking at a return, they look at those fair rental days for how profitable the property was and kind of what portion of the year you owned it. So if your tax professional defaults and a lot due to just putting 365 for that number or zero, your lender is going to look at that property and think you owned it all year and it just didn't perform very well and didn't make very much money. When if you really only bought it in November and got it rented, your fair rental days were only 60. You only had it for a couple months. So that's one of those big things that isn't hard. It just gets overlooked a lot. Won't change your taxes, but your lender might kind of fuss at you because they've got to do some extra due diligence to dive into when you actually got this property. So that's one of the big things that we see a lot of the time. On that same page, when you're on your Schedule E, another thing that relates to real estate that won't show up on Schedule E, but is kind of an added page to your tax return, is look for your elections. So you'll hear people talk about different elections you can make when it comes to taxes, that you can elect to have something taxed a certain way, or there's like, you'll hear people talk about a de minimis safe harbor election. So there are just different elections you can make on your tax return that basically say you want a certain tax treatment. And the ones that come up the most often with real estate are the small taxpayer safe harbor. And so what this is what you're going to want to look for on your return is there'll often be a page that'll say that, and it'll list the tax code for it, which is 1-263A-3H. So it'll say literally that across the top, and then it'll explain that this is basically an election where you're choosing based on the basis of your asset and your expense for the year to write off repairs that are of a certain amount. So it works well with certain properties if you're doing only one large repair and there's no other smaller repairs, but just look for that on your taxes. See if you have it somewhere on that return. It should have its own page. And if you don't have it, ask your tax professional, because it could be something that would be helping you tax-wise to utilize. There's another one called the de minimis safe harbor. This is what most people think of. This one is 1.263A-1F. And this is what you'll hear people talk about, where you can just write off anything under $2,500. So in order to do that, and that is a tax law, and you can do that. So if you put in, you know, new carpet or some paint or whatever you put into your property, but it's under that $2,500 mark, you don't even have to kind of dive further into treating the repairs. Like, it's just small enough, the IRS has write it off. So same thing there, but you have to have that election or you're technically not correctly following the tax code. You have to tell them you're planning to do that. So you want to make sure that's on there. And the other big one that gets missed is it's a grouping election. And I don't have that code on me offhand, but basically if you're going to claim real estate professional status, which lets you avoid any kind of passive loss limits, so you can write off any losses your rentals generate, but it's based on hours. And if you are telling the IRS you're a professional based on how much time you spend on all of your rental properties, there's an election you have to make on your taxes that's called a grouping election that says you're going to take your 10 buildings, your 10 rentals, and treat these as one business. Otherwise, the IRS is going to look at each individual one separately. So if you have any kind of real estate on your tax return, you should have some pages that list, you should have probably at least one of these elections. If you go through every page and there's nothing mentioning an election, open up the conversation because there's a chance something was missed or they didn't check the box kind of thing, which seems small until you're audited and they disallow a bunch because you didn't check the box. So those are kind of the first sort of easy things, not a big impact. The next things that we see just missed a lot, these are expenses people miss a lot. And what happens is I think when they're not directly related to real estate, they don't, or to the property, they don't always get captured. But there's a lot of expenses that you can take related to your rental activities that a lot of accountants miss or people just miss in their record keeping. Probably one of the bigger ones is a home office deduction. So you absolutely can qualify for that with your rentals, as long as your rentals meet the level of a trade or business, which isn't real hard. It's just that you're continually involved with them with the intent of profit, which is what most of us are doing. So you can have a home office. Your auto expense is another big one. Your mileage. People lose miles like crazy, and that's 58 cents a mile. It adds up real quick. Keep track of that. And if your rentals aren't nearby, I hear that a lot. Well, I'm invested in another state. Well, okay, you probably still go to the post office, the bank, talk to your agent, meet other investors. there's a good chance you have some kind of mileage expense, personal expenses that you use for your property, you know, a portion of your personal cell and internet become deductible, things like that. Any memberships, if you're paying for ListSource or Bigger Pockets or local meetup memberships, like don't miss any of those. So it's a lot of these costs that aren't directly, like they won't run through your business bank account all the time, or maybe they're not directly on the property, that get missed. So just sit there and kind of think about everything that you've spent money on that you wouldn't have if you weren't involved with real estate, and make sure you're capturing all of that.
Is a simple way to keep track, because when I hear things like that, you know, and we're sitting here as investors, you know, our primary focus is finding deals and finding money. And so when you're thinking through, you know, all the things that have to get done in the course of running a business, this sounds like parasitic drag on our brains, right? Yeah. It's like, okay, gosh, keeping track of mileage. Is there more simple ways to tackle that stuff? Or is it just that we've got to keep, we just have to do what we have to do? I mean, why not just have the company buy the car? I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here, but...
Yeah. So if it's a totally business use car, you can. If it's shared use though, if it's like your main car that you're also using for business, you have to track your mileage either way because you have to allocate it. There's apps like MileIQ is an app most people use. That's kind of the easiest to keep track of it. And then what I tell people is kind of easiest to try to keep track of all of your stuff is use one bank account for all of your real estate stuff. Don't mix it. Try as hard as you can to kind of keep it in one place. So even if it doesn't make it onto your spreadsheet because it's not your taxes and sort of your interest, your sort of standard real estate expenses, if it's in that bank account, you'll grab it at some point at the end of the year. But what I tell people too, and you're right, your number one focus should be finding deals, running your properties, creating better realtors. And one of the things that I hear from people as soon as they do it is that they should have gotten a bookkeeper quicker.
Right.
And we don't even offer bookkeeping. This isn't my sales pitch, but for most people, like one good deal a year will offset that cost. And like, that is not a good use of your time.
Certainly not. Yeah. And I think the, you know, one of the ways that we get around a lot of this kind of tracking of stuff is just have a dedicated LLC credit card where it's like, okay, if I know that this is a company expense, and then you don't have to delineate between personal and business. I'm not digging back through personal. It's just each LLC is siloed and its expenses are siloed inside of those accounts. And then you're not dealing with going, oh man, I wonder if.
Yep. And what I tell people too is find what works for you. People are always asking me, what's the best system? I'm like, it's like asking the best diet, like which one will you stick to? It's like whatever you'll do every day or you're willing to work it. Like that's the best system.
That's fantastic. Let's keep rolling here. I'm liking what we're hearing so far. We've heard Schedule E. We've heard some elections people miss. We've heard expenses people miss. And those sound like some of the lighter end side of what you're seeing.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the things where, like I said, your tax person probably isn't awful. It's just, this maybe isn't their jam. They just didn't think to ask about it kind of thing. So you're still good. You can probably still go back to them. A big one that we see a lot, and I'll try to keep this as kind of brief as we can, but short-term rentals, they are kind of an in-between, and they're newer relative to the big picture of investment strategies. And so a lot of tax professionals just don't know how to treat them correctly. And so the first thing to look for is if your short-term rental is on Schedule C, where an ordinary business goes, instead of Schedule E, where a rental goes, there's a good chance it should not be there. And there's a few things that happen because of that. One, anything on Schedule E that's an ordinary business pays self-employment tax, which is a 15.3% tax. It's the combination of those little taxes that come out of your paycheck, that FICA, Medicare, Social Security. Normally your employer is paying half, you're paying half. If you're self-employed and reporting something as such, you pay both halves. It's an extra 15% tax. There's a very, very rare time that short-term rentals are subject to that. There's three tests it has to meet. The average guest stay, like the amount of time that they stay, the average of those has to be under 7 days. You have to materially participate in the property, which means like not a syndication. There's several different rules or 7 different rules to qualify for material participation. I can send you a link so you can drop it in the show notes so people, if they want to know. But then the big one is that you have to provide substantial services as well. And to the IRS, substantial services are where you're running your short-term rental more like a hotel. is sort of the best way I tell people to think of it side by side. A normal short-term rental, you're still doing what you would do for a regular rental. It's just furnished, but you're only cleaning in between tenants. You're only providing sort of these basic things. You're not offering business type services, whereas substantial services would be more like a hotel. If you're offering daily cleaning, you can have a maid come by and do a turndown every day. If you're offering meals on site, and like you see this in Europe sometimes at short-term rentals, all your meals are lumped in with your stay, but you don't see it here so much. So very few people have I ever seen where their Airbnb really offers enough that it's being run more like a business and needs to be over there. So if you look on your taxes and your tax professional has put your short-term rental on Schedule C, you need to discuss this with them before you end up paying extra tax.
That's a great point.
So that is a real big one to check. And like I said, I think they just default to putting it there because they don't know. They know it's different than a normal rental, but they're not sure exactly how.
Right.
The other part of that that's a little harder to check for, but that you'll want to talk about and be mindful of is, like I said, short-term rentals are kind of this weird hybrid. And so some of them can actually be non-passive by nature, which they still stay on Schedule E. They're still a rental. But basically, there's sort of the way the laws are worded. If you meet those two of the three requirements, so if you're materially participating in the property and your average stay is under a week, but there's no services, you're technically non-passive to the IRS, which is good or could be good, because with passive properties, your normal rentals, if you generate a loss, a lot of the time those losses are limited based on your income levels. There's a passive loss limit. If your short-term rental, if you can work it into this non-passive category, so if your average stay is under 7 days and you're who's managing it, especially, ask your accountant about this, because a lot don't make this distinction. But if you, especially like if you buy a nice high-end house to run as a short-term rental and you do a cost segregation on it, it's a $700,000 house. If you generate a $40,000 loss that first year, you can potentially deduct it if it's classified correctly. So you really want to bring this up just because it gets overlooked a lot. People don't look at the distinction here, but it can be a huge savings point and a huge strategy point.
Wow. Yeah, this is where we're getting into the side of the show, I think, where little tweaks like that can have an enormous impact on the amount of money you get to keep at year end.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And it's a point to be mindful of, because the difference between having an average stay of 10 days or 7, you can pretty easily manipulate if you want it to be passive or non-passive, offer better rates for short. You know, you've got a few options to sort of wiggle things around, but you've got to be thinking about it ahead of time. At the end of the year, if you're just sort of rolling the dice and hoping for less than 7, that's not a strategy. We don't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Very good. All right. So we've got 4 so far. What maybe is number 5?
Interest. So looking at your interest, and this is something to keep in mind, is that big fan of the BRRRR strategy, big fan of using equity in properties to acquire more properties. You've got to do it correctly. So what the IRS says is that we are allowed to trace interest, which means that it's not deductible specifically against what asset acquired the loan or is securing the loan. You can trace it to where it's being used, and that's where you can deduct it. So if you normally say your primary home has a bunch of equity in it, well, that's not really helping you business-wise. So if you take a second, like a home equity line or a refinance on it and pull out $200,000 and use that to buy two properties outright, normally that interest might not be deductible or your taxes, et cetera, related to it because it's on your primary. You might be limited. If we are using the proceeds of that loan for acquiring investment properties, we get to deduct the interest of that portion of that new loan against those investment properties. So this gets missed a lot. Make sure you tell your accountant, basically, if you get a 1098, one of those mortgage forms at the end of the year, and it says it's for your primary home, they might not think to ask what it was used for, because what you've used those proceeds of that loan for is what's going to determine if it's deductible or not sometimes. So you always want to let them know, like, I pulled out $100,000, but I bought a new rental with it, or I did this with it, or I, like, if you used it to buy a ski boat, not deductible probably, unless you ran a vacation business, you know, but let them know, because it gets missed a lot and there's a lot of interest not being deducted when it could be.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a valid point. And again, you know, how you keep track of those things, you know, that's like you said, everybody's going to have their own way of doing it. But that's that's an excellent point. Fantastic. Number six.
Number six, prior year carryovers. So like I mentioned earlier, if you have a rental and you can't use your losses in that year, they roll forward to the next year. They don't disappear. You don't lose them. My favorite way to explain it to people is if you ever played old school like Super Nintendo and you're playing Mario, and if you already had a raccoon tail, but you got one of the mushrooms, it just like stayed in that box at the top of the screen. Those are your losses. Like you can't use it right now. Doesn't go away. It's just hovering there till you can use it. So those roll forward and those carry forward for the life of the rental. They never just like up and evaporate. But what happens a lot is when someone goes from using TurboTax or doing it themselves to a professional, or if they switch firms, that's something that very often, because it's something that if you're in the same software, it just keeps rolling forward. If you switch softwares or people at all, it has to be put back in and it gets overlooked a lot. And you don't want to lose, if you have $50,000 worth of losses built up that you'll get to deduct one day, you don't want those to just disappear because of a clerical error. So always check your passive loss limitation, your passive loss worksheets, and make sure they match up to the amount you had available on your last year's as sort of your starting point on this year's worksheet.
Yep. That's great. That's great. I love that. All right. Number seven.
Your in-service date. So this is something a lot of people get mixed up with, but on a property, and this is less so on kind of commercial because you've got a bunch of units, but especially on single family, your in-service date is when that property is ready and available for rent. Doesn't have to be rented, just has to be kind of functional at that point, the point where you could take photos or show it to potential tenants, just, or if you were doing a big reno, the point where you get sort of that certificate of occupancy, it's just that point where it could be rented. And the difference on that is that a lot of costs that go into a property before that point get rolled into the overall cost of like your purchase price of the property. Once you're after that point, we have a different set of tax rules. And we can write off a lot more because it's now a functioning open business to the IRS. It's not startup costs, basically. So be mindful of that and some good planning on that in terms of, you know, if you know that you have to do a handful of repairs, there's some major ones, but then you've got a couple grand of just like little things, normal turnover things, paint, carpet, like you can walk someone through and just tell them like, these are all going to be white in a week, but like, that's it. Those things you could write off if you hold off till the week you list it kind of thing. So be mindful of that and make sure you're kind of expressing that to your tax professional ahead of time and knowing when it's actually in service, because you've got some more flexibility tax-wise there.
That's excellent. All right. Number eight.
Depreciation. So this is something that we could do a whole show on. It is often incorrect on returns, but kind of the big things to look for is on your Schedule E on that line for depreciation. I think it's 15 or 18, but it's towards the bottom of the expense list. If there's no amount there, red flag, always check that. And it sounds like a given, but it gets missed fairly often. Make sure there's at least something for depreciation. Then your return should also have somewhere in it a depreciation schedule, or it'll be called like an asset schedule. And it's almost always a horizontal sheet against all the verticals. So you should be able to spot it. Not all tax firms include it by default. Ask for it because you want to look at that. You want to make sure they're using correct amounts. And something that should be really easy to spot is if you just eyeball it and look at the amount they listed. If it is the amount you get to depreciate is equal to the total you paid for the property, you know that they didn't back out land value and you're not allowed to depreciate land. So you always want to look at that report. And even if you're not a tax professional, the amount should be less than what you paid for what you're getting to depreciate. It should say like a depreciable amount, a land amount, and the date in service. So like these are the things that we just talked about. And you always just want to double check those, because if they're wrong to begin with, they stay wrong for the life of the property until you fix it. So it's one of those things.
Yikes. Okay. Yeah, that's certainly something to take a look at. We've got two left here.
Yeah. So the other one is your QBI deduction. This came out a couple of years ago. This is called the QBI or 199A. And this was a 20% write-off on any business income, on anything that wasn't in a C Corp. And a lot of tax professionals struggled to realize that most rentals qualify as a business. And they do. So a lot of people missed out on this write-off. If you have income, if at the end of the day, after all your expenses, that number is positive at the bottom, and there is no amount listed on your actual 1040 on the first page or two for a QBI deduction, then your tax professional isn't treating your rental like a business. So just look for that amount, look for that line, the QBI deduction. And it stands for qualified business income deduction. If you don't see an amount there, even if your rental had net income, not a net loss, discuss it with your tax professional, because you could be missing out on a 20% additional drop in your taxable income.
Wow.
Yeah. What do we got? One more, two more?
One more. We're at nine. So I think
one more. Okay. The last thing that we'll grab off the list here would be flipping income. If you get into flipping properties, we're kind of going a different direction, but good kind of ending point. Most of your costs, most of your expenses carry to the year when you sell the property. They're treated as inventory. So you don't get to just write off things as you go. And then it would basically mismatch things. You'd end up writing off 40 grand year one as you're fixing up a house. And then year two, you'd have this huge income amount. So if your accountant, if you tell them you have a flip, but you just bought it this year and put work into it and it didn't sell till February of next year, or that's when it'll sell, there shouldn't be a huge loss on your taxes this year. So be mindful of that. And the other thing is that flips are typically a business income if your intent is to go in, buy houses and resell them. If your accountant by default is treating them as capital gain, it can be sometimes that's for selling an investment. So if it's kind of a one-off, but if you're doing 10 a year and they're doing that, you're just like a little audit red flag running around. So those are the two things to kind of check for on that. Check how your income's being classified and make sure they're actually not just expensing everything as you go and treating it as inventory.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the less red flags we can wave, the better
yes.
off we are. Natalie, you've done a fantastic job of giving us just some really actionable things to think about when it comes to taxes, when it comes to, you know, planning for the year and thinking ahead. And to be honest, there's even a few things on here I'm like, oh, it's probably something I never really thought about. And I'm about to go back and look at a couple of them on my own and go, I mean, because I'll be honest, for the average individual, myself being below average individual, this is a really confusing topic. I mean, every year I get 150 pages. They hand me a stack of them and say, or maybe it's a PDF at this point, but it's here it is. We're all done. And I go, sweet glory. I really hope this is right. I've asked that question before. Hey, so is this right? Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know where half of these numbers came from. I've got my books. I understand those. But once it gets finally down to that, you know, tax return, it's a mystery to me. And then we're being asked to sign off on it as if we certified as true. Like, I don't know,
yeah.
Which, you know, don't get me started on tax law, but regardless, this is the rules of the game that we play. So understanding it is important. So thank you for putting this together. We'll look forward to that. By the time this show goes live, you know, maybe that'll be available there on your website. So, you know, before we sign off here, can you tell us what is the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So the website for my tax firm is colotax.com. That's just KOLOTAX. So that's the easiest way to get a hold of me. My email is just Natalie@colotax. And then for the book, that'll be also on the nonprofit website, and that's NARETS for National Association of Real Estate Tax Strategists. And that's .org. And so you'll be able to see that on there. And there's also going to be, that also has a bunch of checklists, especially like related to this. It's sort of a checklist of look over your return before you sign it and look at this line, this line, this line, and this line. Because like you said, we hand you the return, and it's like, if once you sign off, you're saying that you agree with it. And most people don't know what they're agreeing with until they're told what to look at.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's a great resource. That's NARETS.org.
Yep.
.org. Yeah. And that's the stuff that the rest of us need is that, hey, go here, look at this. Does this match? That's super helpful. Thank you again for putting these resources together and making them available to us. Again, I do appreciate your time, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, That would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.